So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
This week in Retronauts, some men just want to watch the Y burn. Everyone, and welcome to an exciting episode of Retronauts featuring me, Jeremy Parrish, and also other people who are not me. Let's go around the table and make it quick.
Hey, this is Bob Mackey. I'm a butts man.
Oh, okay.
You know, like they're a leg man and they're an ass man? I'm a butts man.
In America, you're a Barts man.
Yeah.
Do the Barts man.
I don't know how to do that. I'm sorry.
Hi, this is Shivan Butt, and I'm a level 5 death man.
Hi, this is Chris Kohler, and I've been waiting for you this whole time on the other side of this door.
What is that even a reference to? Is that Go-Go?
It's no, it's a reference to Gilgamesh.
Oh, okay. So in case you were wondering, the reason we're talking about butts and doors and wyverns, it's because we're talking this week about Final Fantasy V as the latest episode in our... what is it called? A deep dive series, a series of deep dives into the Final Fantasy franchise. We did skip 2 and 3, but we've done 1 and 4 because those are awesome. And now we're on to 5, which might be even more awesome. I guess there will be some debate in the comments, but I am willing to stump for 5. What about you guys?
I think that Final Fantasy V should always be considered when discussing what is the best Final Fantasy game. Like, I'm not saying it's the best. I'm saying it needs to be in the discussion, in the mix, because it could be.
I agree. It's really hard for me to decide between 4, 5, and 6. They're just all so good for their own reasons.
5 is at least a primary candidate.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, see, 4 has always been my favorite, but after I discovered 5 and realized how much Tactics was influenced by 5, it went way up in my list.
My morning writing ritual goes something like this. I wake up, put a kettle on the stove, and grind some coffee beans. It's only after I've pressed myself a fresh cup of coffee that I can get to work on my latest Retronauts projects. My words don't start flowing until the coffee does, so I'm pretty picky about what I drink. These days I'm drinking Red Rooster's Ethiopia Worka Blend, a single source selection with a mild, slightly nutty flavor. Like everything Red Rooster sells, Ethiopia Worka is made with high-quality, sustainable, organic coffee beans freshly roasted in small batches at the company's headquarters in Floyd, Virginia. Ethiopia Worka is one of this month's subscription selections, which you can have delivered directly to your door every 2 to 4 weeks. Their subscription service is a great way to enjoy fresh, world-class coffees at home, no matter where you live. Each month, they choose from rotating fresh, seasonal coffees and send you coffee based on your specific preferences. To receive your first delivery of Red Rooster's coffee subscription for free, go to redrooster.coffee/retro and use the coupon code FREERETRO. That's one shipment of the freshest, highest quality coffee in the world delivered to your door for free. There's no commitment to continue, and you can cancel at any time. Red Rooster is so confident that you'll love their coffee, the first delivery is free.
Yeah, and another reason we're talking about Final Fantasy V this episode is because of that guy right there to my left. Oh, you can't see because you're listening on an audio podcast. But trust me, Chris Kohler is on my left.
Well, if you imagine that we introduced ourselves in a counterclockwise formation.
Which you don't actually have to imagine because right. That is what happened.
Right. Then I would be on your left.
Correct. So anyway.
Right. Yes.
Tell us what's going on.
Oh, man. I'm so excited to actually say this in public because I've been working on this for a really long time. I have actually written a book about Final Fantasy V for the publisher Boss Fight Books, which is a small press that does – we've probably talked about this on Retronauts before, right? They do individual novella-length works about individual video games. They've done books on Earthbound, Chrono Trigger.
Shadow of the Colossus.
Shadow of the Colossus by Nick Suttner. Anna Anthropy did a book on ZZT. Mm-hmm. They've done some Mario books. But they've never done a Final Fantasy book. And last year – for their Kickstarter, because they do a Kickstarter for each season of the series, the fans voted and made their voices heard that they wanted a book about Final Fantasy VI. And they're getting that. But also, I'm doing a book on Final Fantasy V, which was actually all like totally in the works already before that happened. Yeah.
So this will actually be the second book you've written about Final Fantasy V. The first being the strategy guide that you wrote that Square Enix or whoever then scraped together to put together their Final Fantasy V portion for Final Fantasy Anthology strategy guide. Is that correct?
That is an accurate assessment of what happened, Jeremy. Thank you. Long story short, and in fact, I will get into this in the book. Final Fantasy V was the first game I ever imported because we didn't get Final Fantasy V in America. And as a lover of Final Fantasy IV and VI, it was like, what is this game in the middle of these two games? It must be amazing. And it was. I bought it when I didn't know Japanese. And then I was like, we've got to bring this. We've got to spread the joy. So I teamed up with other people on the internet, one of whom was Nora Stevens, now Nora Stevens Heath, who's a game localizer, worked on Kingdom Hearts and stuff like that. But back in the day, we were both just teens playing Final Fantasy on the internet about 1995, and wrote the first Final Fantasy V FAQ to try to help people who didn't know Japanese make their way through this game if they were to import it. And then, when the Final Fantasy Anthology Final Fantasy finally came out in the U.S. in 1999, they ripped off the FAQ for their strategy guide. And, like, we made a mistake. And then they printed that mistake.
Oh, no.
And then if you know Final Fantasy V, which we're going to get into it, you have an incredible amount of customization control over your characters, which means that when I get to the end of a game, my characters, my four characters and the jobs that they've mastered and the abilities that they have are going to be different than yours. It would be an incredible coincidence, one in a million, if we had the exact same characters at the end of the game. The Final Fantasy Anthology Strategy Guide has here's the characters that we recommend you go into the final fight with. And that is just – they're just my characters from my Super Famicom cartridge that I had at the end of the game that I had written about in the FAQ.
Did they also reprint the sick ASCII art that you put at the top of your I'm imagining
property
it's like
Chris
the logo.
Kohler, do not steal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I have a question. If you imported this game in Japanese, Final Fantasy V has always been a really systems-heavy game. It's not like a story-heavy game, but I feel like the system is so complex that if you don't have an understanding of Japanese, how did you even play it?
Shivam, I didn't say it was a good idea. it was really like I thought it was just going to be like – you don't have to understand. We didn't know. Like there was information about Final Fantasy V that was like, one, it's hard. Two, you can change your character's classes throughout the game, which means that one character could be a white mage and then the next second he could be a dragoon. And you could have four canes in your party, basically. Like, you have to understand the mentality of the American teenager at the time. But had absolutely no way of knowing, like, how crazy it actually was. And so a lot of the FAQ was literally just, like, painstakingly transcribed, and this is all done by Nora, lists of here are the jobs, here are the abilities, just to tell you, like, at least to give you a sense of what the abilities are. And we listed them in Japanese characters as well, so that the idea would be that you'd be able to look at the game, even if you didn't know Japanese, try to identify the characters you were seeing on screen and be like, oh, okay, well, that certain set of Mu language that I don't understand means, you know, a jump or, you know, lance or whatever. Right.
Yes. Always. It's always fun to kind of make that first tentative step into importing games and realize, oh, my God, why didn't I import a fighting game? I'm way in over my head. Because my first game was Final Fantasy or Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Yeah,
which I could have waited like 6 months to play it in English. But at the time, I didn't know. I thought, oh, it's 2D.
This is why I imported DDR first. There's like no Japanese to speak of.
See, she even knows what's up. But we're idiots. So anyway, Final Fantasy V is, get this, the fifth game in the Final Fantasy series if you're not counting –
But it came between 2 and 3. How do you
– If you're not counting Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, which you shouldn't, or Final Fantasy Legend, which that's cute but no. So Final Fantasy V, yeah.
Or Final Fantasy Gaiden, which of course was Seiken Densetsu, which was Final Fantasy.
Right. Did that come out before or after 5? Those were both 92.
I believe.
Oh, it probably came out in 91 in Japan, actually.
I'm guessing that it was before because Final Fantasy V was December of 1992.
Okay. Yeah. All right then. So
we got Tactics in America before 5, right?
We did,
for sure. Yeah. We can get into the sad, convoluted history. But basically, like Final Fantasy II and III, the actual Final Fantasy II and III, we did not see an English version of Final Fantasy V until many, many years after its original Japanese launch. And this was the period where RPGs were kind of, you know, not really sticking to the American audience. And I think everyone was very, very hesitant about what they localized. And that includes Enix, or not Enix, Squaresoft at the time, before it was Square Enix. You know, they brought over Final Fantasy II, and they changed it up considerably, which we talked about in our Final Fantasy IV episode. They brought over Final Fantasy IV as Final Fantasy II and changed it up considerably in the process. They skipped over 2 and 3, partially because of timing, but also just because I think 2 would have been very daunting for inexperienced RPG players in America to deal with. And 3 also was very systems-oriented. So I think
We're talking about the Famicom games now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like those... Well, I think a lot of it probably also had to do with the changing market at the time. By the time they released Final Fantasy I, it was 1990.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Super Nintendo was coming out in the US. But like, people weren't – this was the first like console generation shift essentially. And so people didn't really know what was going to happen to the market. And in fact, the 8-bit market like plummeted like significantly. And I think that may have had something to do with it. Like, oh, we need to get out of this 8-bit market because not good.
They were able to localize Final Fantasy IV in a fairly quick fashion compared to the previous games. You know, Dragon Quest I took 3 years to come to America. Final Fantasy took 3 years to come to America. Mm-hmm. Final Fantasy I came out here in 1990. Final Fantasy IV came out here in 1991.
Yeah.
So they basically just said, hey, why don't we just kind of jump
ahead?
Wow, was
it really only 1 year between Final Fantasy and Final Fantasy?
About a year and like 3 months.
I guess I was so young that it felt like an infinite time between one and two.
Yeah. I mean, it really did feel like Final Fantasy II, which is what they called it here, because...
Well, Final Fantasy was also the scrappy underdog at the time. I mean, Dragon Quest outsold it by millions and millions of copies. And so in the U.S., they stuck with doing Dragon Quest games on the NES, you know, kind of one by one. Mm. But Final Fantasy moved to Super Famicom before Dragon Quest did, like big time, like pretty far in advance. And I think they wanted to try to, like, you know, leapfrog ahead of them. And so I would guess that probably factored into the decision as well. Like, you know what? Let's just, for America, let's just go Super Nintendo. Right. Let's go big. Yeah.
Plus, yeah, because Dragon Quest IV came out after Final Fantasy IV did here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was an NES game as opposed to Super NES.
Right. It was 92.
And look what happened. Yeah. And the Dragon Warrior series just got – it didn't get any more relevant basically, whereas the Final Fantasy series actually did start to establish a name for itself.
Well, I mean Final Fantasy II when it came out obviously was just so epically – incredible to look at compared to Dragon Quest.
And listen to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So Final Fantasy IV came out here in America as Final Fantasy II in 1991. Final Fantasy V came out in Japan at the end of 1992. But We wouldn't see another true Final Fantasy game until 6 came here as Final Fantasy 3 in 1994. So in the interim, what Squaresoft did was look at the games that were coming out in Japan and say, maybe those – like this one especially, this really complicated one with all the systems and everything and the high challenge level, maybe that's not really ideal for the market right now. So what we got instead were Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, a game custom built basically by the team that would create Final Fantasy Legend 3 a few years later as a very much a beginner's RPG. It's extremely linear. It's extremely simplistic. It's, you know, it has a little bit of that kind of like Final Fantasy mechanics in it, but not much. It's really, really like baby's first RPG.
Was that released later in Japan as Final Fantasy USA?
It was.
Okay, I thought so.
Yep.
Wasn't sure if that was just Super Mario.
Yeah, Super Mario USA, Final Fantasy USA. Yeah.
Yeah. We also
Racing
got
USA.
they localized, like they knew the Final Fantasy name means something. So they localized Makaitoshi Saga as Final Fantasy Legend. They localized Seiken Densetsu as Final Fantasy Adventure, which, you know, fair enough. That was actually made as a spinoff of Final Fantasy. And they even localized other companies' RPGs. They localized Breath of Fire from Capcom.
Yeah.
We can debate over whether that was like instead of Final Fantasy V. But they chose to bring that. They chose not to bring Final Fantasy V. So
true.
It wasn't necessarily like a trade-off. Like we're gonna skip five and we're gonna bring this Breath of Fire RPG. They looked at the games and said
it did feel like that at the time for sure, but it's not. Yeah, they didn't like have the two of them in each hand and be like, well, which one do we do?
Right.
Yeah.
Just like we didn't get Secret of Evermore instead of Seiken Densetsu 3.
Right.
It was more like they wanted to build a business that made sense in America, so they created their own game.
I mean, as a kid, it felt kind of like, wait, why did we miss this game? But now as I look back and you look at the market and stuff, you realize that a game like Final Fantasy V, which was so fundamentally different from the way a lot of the JRPGs we had at the time, would have really confused people like me when we were like 10, 11, 12 years old. And it would have probably just, you know, fell like a rock in the market.
I think there was an age gap. I think there was an age difference in terms of – I think you actually did have more adults playing Final Fantasy games in Japan versus the U.S. They probably looked at the market and determined it really was a lot of younger
kids. Well, yeah, because I mean those guys got Final Fantasy 1 so much earlier than we did and they grew up with it.
Yeah,
not even an age thing, just an experience thing because the Japanese market became quickly saturated with Dragon Quest clones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As soon as Dragon Quest hit it big – like every fifth game on Famicom was a Dragon Quest clone. Everyone made their own Dragon Quest clones. Final Fantasy was kind of inspired by that. They said, let's do something a little different.
Right.
And so, you know, by the time it got to Final Fantasy V, there were five Dragon Quests in the market. There were four other Final Fantasies. There were countless clones. There was like Megami Tensei.
Mm-hmm.
There were, you know, Phantasy Star games, et cetera, et cetera. Like there were so many RPGs for people to have built experience with that when they looked at the systems in 5, you know, they also had 3 come before that. So that was like 5 was built on the systems in 3, Final Fantasy 3.
Exactly.
So, you know, so when the game came out, it was just like the next logical progression. Like, hey, here's a game that's even more, you know, complicated and more interesting and more customizable than what you've seen before. Whereas here, it would have been this crazy leap forward, especially after Final Fantasy IV, which is the opposite of this. It is an extremely linear game. It is an extremely it is a game that offers practically zero customization options.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the difference between 4 and 5, I feel, is one of the fundamental RPG differences in, like, terms of tabletop philosophy. Like, 4 was very much an on-rails, linear, you are going to follow the path the DM is telling you.
Yeah, this is the DM telling you
how to
play
the game.
Right,
you are going on the story. It is going to go from here to here no matter what. And 5 was very much like the sandbox. Like, okay, your character can be whatever you want. Here's a bunch of plot points you can eventually get to.
Like, here's the dungeon maps. Just go go do the thing with your character sheets.
The DM will let you do what you want as long as you eventually get to the end. Mm. And just in America, I mean, yeah, Western RPGs and gamers and stuff had that kind of feel. But the kids who were playing consoles maybe didn't have that, like, 20 years of
RPG
experience.
Yeah, kids who were playing Super Mario Brothers were not playing Wizardry and The Bard's
Tale. Or Ultima or something.
Right. Mm.
I also think if they would have localized this and let's say it released in maybe fall of 93, it would have looked kind of bad for a 1993 game. This is not a great looking game. I mean, no, the enemy sprites are fine looking.
It's arguably uglier than Final Fantasy IV, which is
– Oh, I don't think that's an argument.
it's a step backward visually.
It's kind of awkward looking, I think.
Yeah.
And by the time this would be coming out in America, we're moving towards multimedia. We're moving towards like, you know, these pissing contests about graphics. And I feel like this would have made Square look bad because –
Final Fantasy V or Myst.
Yes, exactly. But I mean,
they really were. I mean, and they decided that in lieu of localizing Final Fantasy V, or that they essentially would just jump ahead, basically, Fantasy game instead of getting jammed up on that.
And from 6 onwards, it felt like that was when they really were devoted to making the best possible graphics with that and things like Chrono Trigger, Secret of Mana. Before that, was kind of the same way. I feel
they kind of found their style.
They tried to break away from with 6 the. Like, this game looks like a grid of squares.
Right. Yeah,
you know what I mean?
For sure.
You really see the hard, hard edges of the grid in 4 and 5 and, of course, the Famicom ones. With 6, I think they really actively – I mean, just from looking at it, I really feel like they tried at every corner to make things asymmetrical, you know, to make the edges of things, you know,
round.
Jagged or rounder or right.
Everyone's
you know?
Much and, taller, yeah. too, not as squat.
And even the
regular
proportions.
Everyone's taller. And even just the regular map screen, like – it's always doing mode 7, so it can sort of play with perspective in that kind of sense. Square loves graphics. Like, a lot of people are like, oh, RPGs are gameplay, not graphics. Square's Inception.
They like both.
When they started first making PC games in Tokyo, their whole pitch was like, we are really good at graphics. Our graphics, we're able to choke out a lot of performance with these amazing visuals that we're doing. So
yeah, I mean, even in the early days, they made like a Space Harrier clone for Famicom for NES that used, you know, 3D red blue anisotropic graphic glasses. So,
didn't they do that in Rad Racer as well?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
3D World
both
Runner.
Of those games. Yep, 3D World Runner and Rad Racer, both of them. So yeah, there was a lot of technical prowess.
Yeah, like
going
I feel
there.
Like that in between 5 and 6, Square had like kind of a civil war internally of who wins, the systems guy or the story guy. And it felt like they went with the story guy afterwards because, you know.
I don't think that's entirely true, but we can argue about that in some other episode.
I do remember when FF7 came out, a lot of old Square fans were kind of eating the sour grapes because now the thing they liked was popular. And they're like, oh, Square only cares about graphics anymore. It's like, no, haven't you paid attention to all of their SNES games from a certain point? Like, they always like graphics.
Yeah. So Final Fantasy V, I think you see a little bit of them trying maybe a couple of new things to make it technologically a little bit nicer than Final Fantasy IV, but really it just looks like Final Fantasy IV.
Yeah, I would say the effort in this game was put more into the expressiveness because your sprites suddenly are they can do more than just like look down to be sad. That now they have like
little bubbles.
They can laugh. They can have like little hearts in their eyes, basically. Like there's
that creeped me out when I saw that.
This was I mean, we all remember back in the day, Street Fighter II was 16 meg. It's like Street Fighter II was a 16 meg cartridge, the first 16 meg cartridge ever. It's so huge to be able to hold all these sprites. Final Fantasy V was a 16 megabyte cartridge. Final Fantasy V was a 16 megabit. Cartridge also
Let's not get crazy,
and they used a lot of that. Well, they used a lot of that space for all the sprites, but for all the emotive, like that was a selling point.
Well,
all the emotions of the sprites,
not just the
replay. Final Fantasy IV, all anybody does is look at the camera and nod for an expression,
or lift up one hand.
Yeah.
Yep. But Final Fantasy V, they made
like
a big deal
around.
About like, oh, they might be shocked, or they might have a little love heart appear above their head. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, in addition to the expressiveness, there was also the huge number of different sprites for each character. And we'll get into that. But every character has, what, like 16, 20 different classes they can be in? And each 22. And each character has his or her own look for that class.
Yep.
So this is a long way from, you know, Final Fantasy III's Onion Knights where every character looks the same. These are custom-designed sprites for each character and it kind of gets at their personalities. But yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Also, the people who made – how many playable characters are there in Final Fantasy IV? Like a 14,
dozen? 14, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So now there's literally 22 potential job classes times 5 characters equals over 100.
It's a lot of sprites.
Character. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So
from the perspective of the person drawing them.
Oh, for
so,
sure.
So yeah. So it's not as – you know, as glorious looking necessarily a game as Final Fantasy IV. It's not the big step forward that IV was, but it's a different kind of advancement. So anyway, going back to the history of this, you know, even though Square skipped it, there was always this sense of, like, we want to bring it to America. They clearly had a lot of fondness for it because I remember I think it was EGM or Nintendo Power interview when Final Fantasy VI came out here as 3. Ted Woolsey, the localizer for the game, was like, yeah, you know, we skipped over a game and we really want to bring that. So we want to bring it as like Final Fantasy Extreme because it's not as good looking a game, but it's really, really complicated. And, you know, it's a good challenge for people who cut their teeth on these games. Like once you get used to Final Fantasy 2 and 3, quote unquote, then why not try Final Fantasy Extreme? And there was a PC port that was being worked on sometime in the interim, like around the time Final Fantasy VII came out. And I think they like halfway finished that because then they used the script in the eventual U.S. release Final Fantasy Anthology for PlayStation in 1999. And that script is also halfway finished.
Yeah, and that's why – so it turns out that's actually why we even got Final Fantasy V in 1999 is because you know, it all came about because when they released Final Fantasy Anthology, of course, the Japanese version had Final Fantasy IV.
Right,
and
yeah.
That was not translated for the U.S. at that time. And the Gaming Intelligence Agency, Andrew Vestal, wrote to Square to get a comment on this and found out that – and then Square commented back and they said – We had the Final Fantasy V text already translated from the fact that we were trying to make this PC port. So that is 100% that came from the PC port.
Well, there you go.
And it sucks. And
yeah, it's really bad. Yeah. But finally, the game did come out in America as, like I said, part of Final Fantasy Anthology, which was a collection. I mean, basically, Square released each Final Fantasy game individually in Japan as a PlayStation game. There was 4, 5, 6. I think they knew that wasn't going to fly here, so they put 5 and 6 together. It was like, here's 6, the game you love, and also this other game you never got to play.
That was kind of the pitch, yeah.
It was the pitch, and I was really excited to play Final Fantasy V. And I, you know, despite the emulation problems and the bad load times, I played all the way through that game and loved every minute of it.
You also got a kind of okay soundtrack with that. That was a mix of 5 and 6 music with the anthology.
It was kind of okay, although the funny thing is like that disc did not include – it was like, oh, all the best tracks from Final Fantasy 5 and 6. Okay, well, the opera's not on there. And Battle on the Big Bridge was not on there. Yeah. So it's like for some reason they left off like the two most popular tracks. Although Battle on the Big Bridge would take a little while to become popular in America, but it definitely did.
Right. No, I mean I remember when that anthology came out because I was a freshman in college and you know at my anime club – we were all like, you know, oh, of course it's Tina, not Tara, and all of that sort of thing. And when Final Fantasy V finally came, we were just like, oh my God, it's here. I mean, even more exciting than 6 because we were all – everybody knew 6 inside and out. And having a brand new game in English, which even though we were all a bunch of weeaboos, we still prefer English to Japanese. But man, that game was just loaded so slowly.
Oh, yeah.
And it was so weird to – I mean, it was just unexpected, and I think we all kind of just fell off it until way later.
One thing I don't want to pass up is the fact that there was a fan translation of this game 2 years prior to the official release in America, which was, I think, one of the first major important fan translations ever released. It was in 1997, maybe 6 months after people figured out SNES emulation in a reasonable way.
It wasn't – yeah. I mean by the time that game was translated, a lot of Super Nintendo emulators didn't have sound.
Like, yeah.
They translated that game before the emulators could even really handle playing that game.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite the first fan translation because like,
– oh, not the first, but I think the first
but it's, one important – well, it's almost one of the first milestones. No. I mean somebody had translated SD Snatcher for the MSX, but they were – for the MSX. Yeah. But what they were doing was that was a disk-based computer. So they were literally just like copying it on floppy disks and stuff like that. Final Fantasy V, I believe, was the first – certainly the first RPG, but I think the first like – console game that originally started as a ROM that had to be ripped, you know, and then was translated back.
The birth of ROM hacking, I guess, happened with this translation.
It was all around the same time.
Interesting.
So who was the guy who did – was that Neil Corbett? Was he the guy who –
it was the elusive Shadow.
Shadow?
SOM2 Freak also.
Yeah, a bunch of people were –
It was in and out.
Yeah, they were all competing against each other because everyone was an angry teenager when they were translating games. And then they decided to work together.
Well,
and
that comes from, you know, like the demo scene and the cracking scene where everyone was like – you know, they wanted to put their own little demo in there to say, like, we did it first. Yeah. That was very much a hacker thing from the 80s.
I remember this belief at the time when they were working on it that it was – that, like, it was never going to get done, that it was too hard, that it was way too – like, there was so much complicated stuff that had to get done to translate a ROM that, like – It was just never going to happen, and it was a pipe dream. And now it's like
everything is translated.
Everything you ever want is translated. Yeah.
But I did play through this version, the fan translation version. Nice. It felt like magic. Like, there is an unreleased Final Fantasy game, and I am playing it for free. And I am like, life cannot get better, and it didn't. So my life peaked in 1997 with playing that emulated game.
Yep.
everyone was surprised by
that. Sorry, Bob.
It's okay.
And honestly, if you look, you know, the interesting thing is the endurance of that fan translation. Like, that really, like, that is people's preferred method of playing that game. A lot of people today, because, like, you could play the PlayStation 1 version, but that stinks.
Yeah, it has terrible load times and a terrible script.
Right.
Yes.
It would have been nice if Nintendo or somebody had translated Final Fantasy V on, like, Virtual Console on Wii U because it's available in Japan, but that didn't happen.
Nope.
So basically at this point, probably the best way to play it is the fan translation. And a lot of, like, one of the major localization choices that they made, the character's name was Kirle, K-R-I-L-E, officially. And they were like, what is this? And they translated it as Kara.
Mm.
And that... really, like, any resource about Final Fantasy V, it'll always note, like, oh, you may know this character as Kara. Like, that's really taken hold.
Isn't that character has an impossible to transliterate name, like Kululu or something
that? Yeah. So here's one of the weird things that I found out, because I've been, you know, doing a lot of research about Final Fantasy V. When we wrote the FAQ, the only resource we had was katakana renderings of her name, which was Kululu. And I always assumed that somewhere in the documentation it was spelled out in Roman letters like all the rest of the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't find it. I've been over every inch of the Japanese strategy guides. I mean, the instruction manual, which has nothing, but, like, the strategy guides, all I see is it written in katakana. So it's possible. It's possible that name might be in some other piece of supplementary reference material that I don't have, like on the back of a trading card or something, because, yes, there were trading cards. but it's possible we just didn't know how her name was spelled until the PlayStation version. But, yeah, we spelled it as Kururu, K-U-R-U-R-U, because that's all we had to go on.
Yeah,
we're just like, the hell is that?
How did they get Kururu out of Kryl?
Because if you were to try to – because the name is pronounced Kurl. And so the only way to really pronounce that in Japanese would be Kururu.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and it's not – people look at it and they're like, Kururu.
No.
it's Kururu with the accent on the first syllable. It's just such a weird name that they couldn't – that's the only way they could do it in Japanese, I guess.
Well, and also the main character's name is Butts. So
yes, it is Butts.
They decided to change that for the official localization.
Because Butts.
Because jokes, yeah.
But although a lot of people, I think, assume – oh, I think it's pronounced Boots. It's pronounced Boots. No, it's pronounced Butts.
Yeah.
If you look at the katakana, it's Butts.
Or Bats.
Bots.
No, it's Butts.
It could be Bats.
But it can't. No, because that's a name they actually do. They officially spell it out.
Oh, you know, no, I'm saying like the way it's written in katakana, it could have been transliterated as Bats.
Yeah. But it's not.
They went with Butts.
The important thing is none of these characters actually have real names.
Right.
No,
anyone else's
actually,
name.
Well, they start with the English names and then they go to
Ferris
the Japanese.
Has two names.
Ferris Bueller?
Yes.
Or Faris, Ferris.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite parts of the PlayStation script is – so
yeah.
Faris is, you know, she was lost as a child her name was actually Sarissa.
Yeah.
But because she was a kid and they were like, what's your name? She mispronounced it as Faris.
Right.
But
or
in
she said Fanifa.
Yeah.
Because she had a lisp because she was a little kid.
But in the in the original localized version, instead of Sarissa, they translated that as Salsa.
Salsa.
Yep. Oh, right. For the love of God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Princess Salsa. Spicy.
Salsa and the Y burn.
She is kind of spicy, though.
That sounds like a morning drive time radio.
You're listening to Salsa and the Y burn here on 106 FM.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
We'll be right back.
And we keep referring to this, and I mean, salsa. You know, well, since we're on the subject, I mean, the many, 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 like, horrible translation errors that they made. And I feel bad because, like, clearly...
Such as Nut Eater?
Clearly they... No, it's called Nut Eater.
I
remember one line of dialogue was an emoticon. It was like a winky face, like Ferris, winky face.
Oh.
I don't think that was the fan translation. I think it was the PlayStation translation. It just took me aback. Like, that isn't an official translation.
So, I mean, basically my read on this is that, like, they probably gave it to, like, one person and they probably gave them a ridiculous deadline and they probably gave them – and they definitely clearly gave them no support. Like, they couldn't call up Sakaguchi and be like, what is – okay, I've got Wa-I-Ba-N. What is that? What is that? Because, of course, he'd be like, it's in the Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual. Look it up. But because they were probably doing it with absolutely no support, they looked at Wa-I-Ba-N, which is a wyvern, and they sadly wrote the letter Y and then
dash
the word burn.
Yep.
It's very cute.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about
– well, have you mentioned what? The – Game Boy one?
No, we can talk about that later. Okay. We'll get to the versions, the remakes and stuff.
You don't
later.
Have to put the book on the floor.
Well, yeah. I didn't want to put it back on the table.
Get that the hell out of here.
Put it right in the fire.
Take it out. Make it sit in the hall.
I didn't want to make it noise on the podcast.
It has to stand in the hall and hold a bucket of water.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about where Final Fantasy V sits in the, like, the design and development and philosophy of the series, because to me it's really interesting just how different it is fundamentally from Final Fantasy IV, the game that came immediately before. We talked about this a little bit, how Final Fantasy IV is extremely linear, is extremely, you know, like the DM story game, whereas this is not. The story is almost like it's there. You're going to go forward and you're going to do stuff because people are telling you, like, hey, this thing is happening, but you're not going to care that much. The real joy of this game is in the systems and the discovery figuring out just what kind of crazy things you can do to make your party so amazingly powerful. It was really, in a lot of ways, a very different approach to the concept of RPGs. You know, you had job systems in games, you know – you had multi-classing way back in, you know, in D&D and then in Wizardry. You had Dragon Quest III, which had the karma, or the Dharma Temple, and, you know, the ability to change job classes. And then you had Final Fantasy III. But in none of those games were the jobs and the abilities you had access to so incredibly empowering as they are here. Those games were tuned and balanced to be right. difficult no matter what. I mean, Final Fantasy III is a brutal, miserable endurance test, especially mm-hmm. at the very end. Whereas this game, yeah, there's some crazy hard stuff. Like they started creating super bosses in this game just to challenge you and make you really push your understanding of the skill systems to the limit. But if you understood how everything worked together in the interactions, you could create crazy powerful characters. And I was like, you know, by the time I played through this, you know, got to the end of this game when I played it for the first time on PlayStation, I basically killed X-Death in like three rounds, the final boss, just because I was like, yeah, I was like, oh, you know, I've got this samurai Giltos. Character and he's got Giltos and I've got all this money, so I'm just going to chuck money
at
this dude.
Insofar as I'm pretty sure there's no like post-game sequence where I'm going to need this money. Yeah. Like, I'm just throwing
I was just like, you can have all my money, dude. Here, take it.
But Final Fantasy V to me felt like one of the most modular RPGs I've ever played, in the sense of your character is a literal blank slate. If you're like the freelancer, you've got three slots, or I think, or two slots.
The mime gets three slots. The mimic, mistranslated, I think originally as mime, has three slots. Freelancer has two open slots.
Right. Yeah. And you could take your inherent abilities that you've gained from the various classes and then combine them into your own Voltron. And it was like incredible to be able to just do things like, you know, double weapon and then Ranger's four attack thing. And it felt almost like a Lego set of just being able to slap on pieces and make your own like gigantic monster.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I played 3, but I remember the job system is not nearly as complex or satisfying. Mm. How is it different? I don't really remember.
Okay. So like Shivan was saying, there are a lot of like sort of building block philosophies at work here. The freelance class is your base class. That's what you have to like get through the first dungeon in. You can't cast magic. You can't do anything except attack and use items.
And there's basically no reason to switch back to freelancer, you know, throughout the course of the game.
Because you you it doesn't have any skills attached. And when you – okay, so this is a sort of a big innovation in the game is that when you actually, maybe three did this. But when you finish a battle, you get experience points and then you get ability points. And the ability points go toward whatever job you're currently currently classed in. So if you get ability points when you're a freelancer, it's worthless. Like you've just wasted those points that you earned in combat. So yeah, it doesn't really make sense to become a freelancer until you've explored all these other classes and you've built them up. And then you go back to freelancer and what you can do is you can take any skill that you've mastered from another class and you can put like three or four of those into your freelance class and
Two.
Well, it felt like three or four
But you can still make things happen.
You basically are creating your own custom character. Mm-hmm. Like they are a multi-class character and they're not learning AP, but it doesn't matter because you've got the skills you want and you're crushing everything in your path.
But at that point, you might as well – like, I can make a freelancer and he can have white magic and the ability to slice things up with a katana, right? But at that point, you might as well just make a ninja and give him white magic because any character can take on one of whatever abilities you have learned. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't the freelancer get extra bonuses at the end if you mastered all the classes?
Yeah. So the only thing with the freelancer is if you master a class, which is you get to the final level and you can no longer upgrade that class, any passive abilities of that class are visited onto the freelancer or the mimic at the end whatever. I mean, so basically, yeah. So if you switch back to freelancer and like you mastered white mage, all the stat bumps that a white mage would get, like, oh, you know, I get extra, you know, magic power, whatever – that gets visited on.
And that's also stuff like the geomancer's resistance, right? Like
elemental resistance. Anything that's not a thing you have to slot in.
The moves exclamation
point. Yes. So, I mean, if you want to master – you probably want to master Geomancer with somebody. Then, therefore, when they go back to Freelancer, then they'll be able to, walk on lava. The thief will be able to see hidden passages. Like, these are all innate things if you have that person in your party. Mm-hmm. So, all that stuff counts. The ability to two-handed equip, which you brought up. Because the classic that everybody does – and, in fact, I think in Dissidia Final Fantasy, when Bartz, who was in Dissidia Final Fantasy, when he uses his, like – big old special move. This is the move. It's magic sword, which is you enchant your sword with a magic spell, plus dual wield.
Yes.
Which, interesting, the freelancer can do a lot of stuff, but the freelancer cannot dual wield. Only the ninja can. But if you master ninja, then your freelancer can dual wield. And then plus the ranger's essentially scatter shot ability where they fire four random arrows, which does half damage. Mm. So, I mean, this might be a good time for you to mention because I think we do the same thing when we play Final Fantasy V, which is we hang out in the Battle Castle basement for a long time.
And so, in the basement of this one random castle in the game where if you were able to graph out any like Final Fantasy V players kind of playthrough in terms of where they spend most of the time, I would guess about 40 to 50% of your time in the game is spent in the basement of this castle running back and forth looking at these stupid statues which happen to be like level 25 or some multiple of 5.
Oh, I know you're talking about.
That you could then use the ability level 5 death.
Which is an unblockable instant kill attack on anything that is a multiple of level 5.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was like an old trick from Final Fantasy Tactics futuristic trick.
It was imported into Final Fantasy Tactics.
It was retconned back into 5.
It was presaged into Tactics. But yeah, no, in Final Fantasy 5, we sat there for hours walking back and forth, summoning these stupid statues, obliterating them and getting a lot of AP out of those guys.
But that's not all-inclusive. I don't do that.
You don't do that. So one group – so if you encounter two of these enemies, you get 4 ABP, which is a lot because most battles in the game give you
like
one ABP.
Or two, yeah.
Right. If you beat a boss, you might get 4 to 7, 4 to 8, whatever.
Yeah.
So they give you 4, which is a ton. And also because you have level 5 death, which is not forced into your hands at the game. You have to go looking for it. Also, here's the thing with level 5 death. I believe – I could be wrong on this. I think you can only get it in World 1. Which means by the time you get to that castle, you can't – I'll go get level 5 death and come back.
Right.
You can't at that point.
Yeah, but I mean folks like me who are just hardcore, got to catch them all types, I would make sure to max out everything in all the world. And when I discovered this, I discovered it independently.
Find this out on your own?
Yeah, and it was amazing. And then when I realized it was like the most universal trick that I ever wrote, I felt kind of less better, but also at the same time, I'm like, yeah, I found this.
That's right.
I just remember being really angry at you because you were complaining about how boring the game was because you were just standing around farming level, you know, like ABP from these guys.
Yes.
I was like, well, you know what? You don't actually have to do that. You can play the game the way it was intended and earn these ability
points
naturally.
But I could master all the classes.
Well, the other interesting thing about that is they pretty much put that there deliberately. Like they knew what they were doing. But then also, you know, those characters don't give you very much experience points.
Right.
So you can stay down there for 10 hours grinding ABP, and your character's base stats, you maybe level up a couple of times. So you can't totally break the game. The only thing you can get a lot of ABP, but you still have to think about where it's going
to
go.
Right. And to me, frankly, that was one of the more fun parts of the game because I love that kind of puzzle of being able to – how do I design my character? How do I – allocate this stuff to make a really interesting balanced party. I mean, you could have all four of your people be identical, but for me, it was more interesting to be able to just really diversify. And I found that I just kind of wanted to get all of the classes and stuff unlocked so that I could just move on with the rest of the game and then be able to just tinker with it as I went.
But the reward for grinding these guys is so addictive because, again, like I said, one group of two gives you four, a group of five, which you encounter a lot, gives you eight. And level five death is. It just works instantly across the whole group. Most of your time is spent just waiting for everybody to die because the death animation. That's essentially most of your time. And you get so much ABP from these guys. So, and also, playing it on Super Famicom is like, okay, well, I'm sitting in front of my TV and only doing this. You're going to get more bored. Last time I played this game, I was on the Vita. And it was just like, I'm not even thinking about what I'm doing. I'm literally just pressing buttons and I'm watching TV. Uh-huh. And so I did it. I pretty much did this in like nightly sessions for about a week. And so I probably put about 10-ish hours into it. And I did go for Bartz to get that classic ninja. So basically what happens is you get Magic Sword, you get Ninja, and you get the Archer Scattershot. And then you turn Bartz into a freelancer or whoever.
Yep.
And then you pick... You add Scattershot to your list of abilities and you pick it. And because you have two weapons in your hands, he attacks eight times randomly for half damage.
So good.
So I actually spent so much time in that castle. And this is just a little after the halfway point of the game, just a little bit more than halfway through the game. I changed everybody to freelancers, and I never looked back. I forewent all the rest of the ABP, and literally, I could one-shot with Bartz almost every battle, including bosses in the game, for the rest of the game.
Yes.
And honestly, you're looking at me really like, well, that's not fun. It was kind of fun.
No, it pretty much
was kind of fun.
No, that's fine.
Like a machine of
death. My only issue is when someone like Shivam says, this game is so boring because you have to grind. You don't have to do that.
Nope.
And in fact, I never do, and I love the game, and I have so much fun playing
it. But I'm super OCD, and so when you give me something...
But that's not a problem with the game, Shivam.
Okay, so I played this on Game Boy Advance. That was my first real experience with Final Fantasy V. And like Chris said, being able to just sit there and do this whenever you want on the bus ride to school or whatever it was just easy for me to sit there and just kind of grind through this. And if you give someone like me the ability to grind out and just sit there and max out everything in like no resources expenditure, I have no reason not to. I was going to like, put this tool in front of me that says max out the game and the rest of the game is easy. I'm like, why would you do that now? Do that in the post game or something. Don't just give me the gun and tell me not to shoot it.
That's fair. But I think it's interesting that you talk about, like, you know, Bartz being the sort of default to turn into the bruiser character because
it was Ferris for me.
I don't know why, but every time I play this, I always turn the male characters into, like, the mages And then I'm like, okay, girls, go for it. Yeah. Crush everyone in your path.
That's what I do now because I grew up just with the idea like all the women are magic users, all the men are the brutes or whatever, or the warriors. But then like, I don't know, when I became more woke, I was like, no, it's the opposite this time.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm not even woke. I was just like, it's more fun if the girls kill everything.
Yeah, the funny thing is Final Fantasy V actually tricks you on that twice because
– The Fork Tower?
No,
you're talking about the number of
– when you first start the game, you believe that you have three men
party
and
of
one,
three men,
one woman.
That's right.
Then you find out maybe after you start specking out Ferris a little bit that actually this guy is actually a woman. So maybe you've already started Ferris on a path that you subliminally were like, oh, well, Ferris is a man, so Ferris will be the, you know, berserker. and then later on, spoilers, Galif dies – and is replaced with Curl,
who
is his granddaughter, who's like 10 years old.
Yeah.
So now –
and is also the most incredible monk I've ever had.
Right, exactly. So now if Galif was your bare-handed fist fighter, now its 10-year-old girl is your bare-handed fist fighter. So the game actually kind of switches things up on you gender-wise twice, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Plus, for me, coming from Final Fantasy Tactics, where if you max out the dudes in the mage classes, you get Bard. And if you max out the ladies in the fighter classes, you get the Dancer.
Oh, cool.
So I was already used to kind of like, okay,
oh, that's true.
Let's kind of subvert this because maybe there's a secret at the end.
Actually, my main reason for doing this is I think just because if you turn Lena into a berserker, she has just like the cutest little outfit. And I'm like, I like this little person wearing like,
right.
like a kitty cat. Kitty ears is the white mage.
Oh, white mage.
But she's got like – she kind of looks like Lum, actually. It's like tiger skin.
Yes.
Jeremy's got a type, everybody.
I think the berserker is
– Lum. Aliens.
That's it. I think that the berserker is – everybody's wearing like animal like loin
cloths. Oh, yeah. Animal skins.
But then if you turn Curl into a berserker, she's wearing a full – it's a
like kitty pajamas.
Like kitty pajamas. A onesie. She's wearing a cat onesie. Yes,
I'm really glad Chris brought up how you are introduced to Ferris as a man, but then you find out that she is a woman because this game – game, playing it again
it's
is
Final Fantasy's first gay moment.
More importantly, that is important, but I think it's also one of the goofiest ass Final Fantasy games. Like the tone is all over the place.
Yeah,
there are scenes explicitly played for comedy. Final Fantasy IV had a little goof-em-ups with Palom and Porum, but this game is like, here's a wacky anime scene where they're peeping and they're blushing and stuff like that. It is so anime.
Do I feel so attracted to this man? It's so strange.
Oh, yeah. Gay panic, of course. It's hilarious. Right. But this game is full of comedy, or at least attempted comedy. I don't know if they were just having fun or maybe too much fun, but the story does not take itself that seriously at all times.
Like, yeah, so
it was very dire.
I'm looking through the NES guide here, and the Beastmaster class has all these people dressed up like sheep.
Yeah.
It's just like, what is going on here? Yeah, I mean, the costumes in the game were pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So on that note, I kind of mentioned this earlier, but like – we found there's an interview. It's actually in Shmupulations with Kazuko Shibuya, who was Square's main pixel art designer. Like when you see – I mean that's her style of pixel art. And she does all of the you know in the boxes of the games in Japan, the 4 and 5, the illustrations, the cutesy chibi illustrations of the characters. That's her too.
Yeah.
And she basically in this interview, which was conducted much later, I think it was like 2013, she was just like, oh God, Final Fantasy V. All I did for a year – was draw sprites, battle sprites for the characters.
Like, I believe it.
That's all I did for a year. She was like, I remember yelling at Sakaguchi telling him there were too many jobs.
I mean, that's one thing that did strike me is like Final Fantasy IV, the Japanese box art has like the, you know, the main cast rendered in this like super cutesy style. And then 5 is basically just like, let's just do all of that over and over again. It basically took the Final Fantasy IV Japanese box art and turned it into a game.
Sure.
And think about how many battle animations each character class had on top of that.
Yeah, because they have melee attacks and magic attacks.
And if you're doing something from a different class, you might need to animate that bit too. And it's just like crazy.
It's not, you know, that's where the graphic and apply it to the different character models. Like,
That's where the graphic data went. That's where the memory was used.
So I'm looking at the Final Fantasy IV box art now, and the weird thing is like no character from the game is on the box. It's just these Final Fantasy I classes.
No,
maybe Rosa is on the box, kind of.
Final Fantasy IV.
It's like Fighter, Thief, Black Mage, White Mage, Chocobo, and like there's a woman who might be Rosa. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's totally completely not those characters, which is kind of weird.
Yeah,
that's right.
We'll be right back.
So speaking of Final Fantasy IV, I did want to talk about a few other things. Like, you know, we talked about how in terms of game design and just philosophy, this is so different from Final Fantasy IV. But it does build on Final Fantasy IV in some important ways. Mm-hmm. The first being the Active Time battle system,
right,
which it, you know, takes that innovative F1 race concept of a battle system from Final Fantasy IV and makes it better. Mm. It does some really helpful things. I don't think this one – did it give you the ATB meter indicator? Okay,
it
so that's the first time – yeah, you get the ATB meter.
Yeah.
So you can actually see how long it's going to be until your character gets a turn. It also gets rid of the delays, the active delays once you choose an action.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, when you cast a high-level magic spell, you cast it right away. It's not like in Final Fantasy IV where, you know, you summon a monster and you're like, please, Iridia, don't die before the summon shows up.
I don't know. I really like that, though, because that definitely felt like D&D, right? Like the, you know, you cast a spell and you have to wait around for that thing to happen because
– there's nothing wrong with that, but it does change the nature of combat and becomes much faster and changes up, you know, kind of your strategic considerations.
I think that's also part of the fact that this is such a class-based or modular-based system that you can't really have weapon speed or casting speed when you've got the ability for a player to be anything, because how much extra math would that add?
Oh, yeah.
How much extra coding would that be to like, okay, well, the Beastmaster summons slower than the Summoner does but faster than the whatever does. I mean, I feel like that's just a whole layer of extra just overhead that they don't need, and just giving them like fire and forget instantly seems to solve that problem.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I think that would work, but I do think it would. I don't think it'd be too much for the system to handle, but maybe for players to keep in mind.
I think for designers too, just to consider every possible variable for every
and this game's
class.
Already
again,
got
it,
so
it
much.
Does, it does make the game much faster, and it also means that, you know, like if it took a long time to cast a magic spell, but say, you know, the sorcerer class is able to use enchanted swords, like why would you ever cast magic if you can just, you know, do instant attacks with that other class? So I think –
yeah, there could be some – yeah.
Yeah, I think it kind of gives every class a level playing field and allows it to be not necessarily equally useful. I don't know about the Geomancer or Beastmaster.
It's balanced in different ways. Yeah. It's not – that casting time is not part of the balance essentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
And another sort of similarity that it has, you know, to Final Fantasy IV and also III is the idea of a world sort of broken up into like different chunks. Mm-hmm. Like as you advance through the story, you go to different worlds. And at the end of the game, like big chunks of the world are actually being destroyed and vanishing from the world map. And then you like – I think you can – it's been a while since I played, but you can go to the X zone, right, or the new or whatever it's called. And and like those places have been trapped within that zone, so everything like changes up and becomes like the evil version. So, you know, Final Fantasy IV had the moon, it had the underground. Final Fantasy III were actually in this sort of like isolated fragment of a world and had to restore the rest of it or like discover the rest of it.
No, not really. But they yes, Xdeath comes in and he's like Xdeath being the big bad of the game, sucks certain villages and places in the world into the void, but then you just don't visit them again.
Okay, I couldn't remember if you visited them, but you know, you do lose that. But also there are like different worlds throughout, and you apparently meteors or spaceships, so you travel to these different worlds, like you said earlier. Yeah. Like well, you can't go back to some of them.
The idea is that you're on the first world, and then you find out Galif, when he regains his memory because he's an amnesiac for a while, is like, oh, I come from another planet, and I came here on the meteor to stop Xdeath because we sealed Xdeath away on your planet. Like RB.
Sorry about that, guy.
Basically, and now he's breaking out. And then Galif leaves, and the rest of the party is like, let's follow him to his planet. And then you go to Galif's planet, and Xdeath is there, and you fight Xdeath, and then something happens, and you're like, oh, we're home. Oh, there's Castle Tycoon. Like, oh, that's cool. And then you kind of realize, like, oh, our worlds just smashed together.
Whoops.
And then you find out that, in fact, it's not so much that your planet and Galif's planet just got smushed together. It's that it was originally one planet that had gotten split apart. Mm. And so then – but then – I think from a gameplay perspective, Xdeath comes in and wipes out all of the villages that they don't want to deal with anymore for the rest of the game. Uh-huh. Because world, you know, the third world or the world that's put back together would have a lot of stuff in it for you to do. So then they're just like, Bartz, your hometown has been sucked into the void. So we don't have to deal with writing dialogue for them.
Yeah. And that should be played as a big tragedy, but whatever. Just go kill some stuff.
It is. Bartz gets super mad. He gets super mad and he jumps in his chocobo and he races around like he's, you know. They show his emotions as best they can.
I know, but.
What are they going to do? What are they supposed to do? They're mad. The dude's been, X has been on a murderous rampage for the whole game. Yeah, they're ticked off. They're trying to kill him.
I guess. Just in terms of the writing, there's not that much
time given
to, like, the rich inner lives of the characters.
There's not much time given to very much with Final Fantasy V. Right. But, I mean, you know, with Final Fantasy IV, as we spoke about in that episode, every character was very much defined by their job. Mm. In Final Fantasy V, you can't do that because Bartz could be a white mage as easily as he could be a ninja. Which means that nobody really has much backstory of like what were they doing prior to this. That's why they're all kind of blank slatey type characters, which is why the story is very not character centric at all.
Yeah, it feels almost like Final Fantasy I in the sense of like the characters are just ciphers of whatever you want them to be.
Yeah.
But the fact that they have to have a frame story of any kind at all.
They knew that they couldn't do light warriors and they couldn't do onion kids. Like the characters had to, at this point Final Fantasy IV was being
well,
Final
the
Fantasy
warriors
was so
of Dawn
known
instead.
For its characters. right. But it's like the games are becoming known for their individual characters. The characters had to have names. The characters had to have certain looks to them.
Sure.
Like, that was a big deal. And they couldn't just be, like, four randos. Yeah. But at the same time, they ran into the problem of, well, what do we say about these characters that, you know, doesn't preclude them from becoming a Beastmaster later in the game?
Right.
And they didn't – I mean, it's okay to say they didn't quite get it right.
I mean, they solved it with tactics when they eventually got there because that's the same kind of problem, right? Like –
Well, the problem with that game is that most of the named characters who have backstories come into your party and then where do they go? Mm-hmm. They're no longer part of the story.
This is true.
You can get Miliadul and she's very important until she joins your party, at which point it's like
– Now she's just on the third row over there.
I'm going to turn her into a chemist and I don't know what else. That's it. The one other thing that I think is kind of important that carried over from Final Fantasy IV was – Uematsu's use of leitmotifs.
Big time.
Way the music was sort of structured in Final Fantasy IV, where it's sort of the main theme being iterated on and explored.
Yeah.
Like there is even more of that this time, to the point where people are like, "There's only one song in Final Fantasy V, which is stupid. There's two. There's Battle of the Big Bridge, also.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, yeah,
but you're
like
right.
The main theme.
If you watch the intro to Final Fantasy V, it first of all, it's like one of the more complicated things they had ever done story-wise because you notice if you're trying to read all the Japanese in the Super Famicom game and failing, they're advancing the text automatically because the intro to Final Fantasy V is perfectly synced up with the music.
That's right.
Which is not – because Final Fantasy IV starts famously on the Red Wings, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it just loops and then when you're done, it fades away. Final Fantasy V's intro is a specific one-time piece of music that's perfectly timed to what's happening on screen. And it ends, you know, right when it ends and it changes – based on what's going on. And to your point, you listen to Ahead on Your Way, which is the title theme. Dun, 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 upbeat horns. Then you watch the intro to the game and like you see like Ferris on the ship and the wind stops blowing and you hear underneath it like bah, 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 and it's sort of a, you know, like minor key and it's kind of like creepy now. Yeah. Like there's – rewatch that intro because that intro is – If you bear in mind like what's happening historically with the series, like that's a real
moment.
It's a step forward for sure. Yep,
I do love the actual pre-intro of the game where it's only in the Super Famicom version. It's not in the shitty recent remake. It's not in the GBA version. It's of the Final Fantasy V text, but it's like Boko and Bartz are riding a chocobo. Well, he's riding Boko. God damn it. He's riding Boko.
Boko is riding Bartz.
And it's like scrolling. Yeah. I mean
– you read my fan fiction.
I can't sell this very well, but you know what I'm talking about. It's just like a graphically impressive thing. It's not just the logo.
Yeah,
it's just
like the
it's hard to describe.
Like the letterboxing kind of widens opens up and it shows more of the background.
Yeah, yeah, it's
and
really
the scenery.
Cool.
And then eventually yep. kind of Bart takes off and it like warps into the Final Fantasy V logo.
It's probably the most yeah. graphically really nice. Impressive thing in the game.
Well, yeah,
involving
because
animation.
Most games just had the logo on the screen, if yeah. that, with the prelude.
It's interesting to note that Square used that same exact thing for Final Fantasy Brave Exvius.
Oh,
the
really?
Mobile version, when you're playing it and you're loading stuff, it's got that same exact Bart is riding the chocobo across. And then once it finishes loading, he runs off screen and the logo comes on.
Yeah.
It's like 100%.
It's iconic. I mean, it's, oh, yeah. It's memorable. It really, yeah. It sets the tone for the game too. It's like there's about to be an adventure. I can't wait to go.
Yeah, it's super cool. I love that.
And again, one of the big selling too, points right? I remember back in the day, or one of the things people knew about the game that was really exciting was it was the idea of you have your own chocobo. Because, you know, that was something you had to go out and find in previous Final Fantasy games. But the idea is like you start with a chocobo. And you do. You start out riding yeah. a chocobo. But I mean,
and then he gets written out really quickly.
He does.
And then he has
does.
Babies.
Well, I mean, you can't just have a chocobo all the time. But like you do start out with riding him around the world. That's kind of fun. That's one of those things where it's like, oh, man, I'm so cool. I already have a chocobo.
Well, I mean, in chronological order, right? Like 4 introduces chocobos and everybody's like, wow, look at this. So cool. 5, you have one.
Yeah.
That's cool. That yeah. would have been like if you had started in Japan and – that would have been a really neat feeling, you think?
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
This week's featured game, Final Fantasy V, is all about changing jobs. It's easy to do that in a video game, but in real life, well, switching jobs is a real commitment. Don't make a life-changing career move blind. Consult DICE. DICE can provide insight and guidance about new directions based on your skills, experience, and your location. They'll also show you which skills you'll need to make the move, as well as which career paths are currently in demand. DICE has been connecting tech pros with job opportunities for more than 2 decades, and their full-scale career hub can connect you with the tools and resources you need to manage your career. Whether that means finding your next job, guiding your next career move, or simply offering you some target numbers for when you ask for your next raise, DICE has insight into more than 70,000 tech jobs, including software development, UX, and project management. So you can take a peek at your peers' salary reports or get a sense of which jobs are heating up in your local market. Learn more at dice.com/canyouhackit and hack your career with DICE.
Hi, this is Spike Persons from Spike's Car Radio. Here we are again on the porch in Malibu, and I'm here with the great Jeremy Piven. I'm a huge fan of him and his doggy. Is your doggy's name Frenchie?
Bubba.
Bubba. Well, yes. It says Frenchie on the collar.
I know. He forgets who he is, what kind of dog he is. You know, it's like we could just have a little something that says Jew, right? So we remember this is what I am.
I don't know. I'm not going to call a dog a Jew. I can't.
They did.
Well, we've taken a serious turn here on the podcast. Listen now on podcast1.com, Apple Podcasts, or the Podcast One app.
Need to buy a car but feel wary about the reputation used car dealers have for stretching the truth and your shopping budget? In order to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price, you need pricing context, information that empowers you to feel confident. In other words, you need TrueCar. TrueCar dials you into actual sales data from a network of more than 13,000 dealers, allowing you to connect with a local certified dealer and more than 700,000 pre-owned vehicles. TrueCar allows you to find the exact vehicle you want, whether it's new or used. And with the TrueCar pricing curve, you can find out what others in your area have paid for the same vehicle that you're currently shopping for. On top of that, you'll be armed with the knowledge of real pricing on actual inventory, plus all available sales incentives, before you even make it to the dealer's lot. That's why, on average, TrueCar users have saved more than $3,000 off the MSRP of their dream car across more than 3 million vehicles sold. When you're ready to commit to a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Folks, drop what you're doing immediately and think about one very important topic in your life, your underthings. Odds are they're not in the greatest shape because that's the one clothing item most people don't get to see for themselves. And if your undergarments date back to one of the two Clinton administrations, why not consider treating yourself to a pair of Me Undies underwear? Quite frankly, Me Undies is the softest underwear you'll ever wear. They're one of those products you just have to experience for yourself. I could tell you about them all day long, but feeling is believing. Every pair of Me Undies is sustainably sourced and made from micromodal, a fabric that's 3 times softer than cotton. If you're used to buying boring underwear, Me Undies will change everything, because Me Undies come in all kinds of colors and patterns, and they release new limited edition patterns each month, and they always sell out. This month's patterns were designed by the legendary 80s clothing brand Cross Colors, with names that live up to their bold design and bright colors, like Increase D-Piece, Ya Dig, and The OG. You've got to see them for yourself, and right now you'll save 20% off your first pair and receive free shipping only at MeUndies.com/games. There's a reason MeUndies has sold over 5 million pairs to date. You'll feel it when you put them on. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free. To get 20% off your first pair plus free shipping, go to MeUndies.com/games. That's MeUndies.com/games. MeUndies.com/games.
Geomancer, dragoon, barn, chemist, dancer, samurai.
Okay,
no. Yeah, wait, that. Yes! That's good.
What Joe class, what class assassinates JFK, though? That is the...
Cannoneer?
Yes, cannoneer. There okay. You go. From the grassy knoll.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my attempt to set all the job classes impromptu to the tune of We Didn't Start the Fire.
And you were off and rolling there.
We did an FF5er. Okay. So anyway, yeah, I would
Wouldn't
like to talk.
We didn't localizer.
Nice. Okay. So I would like to talk a little bit about the job classes, because this is where the job system really came into its own. You know, they did it in Final Fantasy III and it was cool, but it just didn't quite work in the way that it does it in Final Fantasy V. But V is so good because you can do whatever the hell you want, aside from some very limited situations like Fork Tower, where you need some physical attackers in one branch and you need some mages in another.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not realize that the first time I played, and I took my wrong characters in into each tower and had a hell of a time, but I did beat it. But my God.
Oh, really?
My God, that was difficult.
You can still hot swap jobs. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah, but I had like specialized, you know. So
sure.
It was like.
Someone
I
didn't maximize in the butt.
That's
basement.
Right. Some people don't
raise don't min-max their characters.
Mm-hmm. Also, really helpful. The shit-ass translation of Final Fantasy V for the PlayStation told you the wrong towers.
Yes. That's what happened.
Really?
I took my characters into the wrong towers because of the translation.
Yep.
Yeah.
I really like that tower, though, just because the idea of having to force you into classes is basically their way of saying, okay, dude, we know you maxed them all out, so now you're going to have to actually try to, you know, unmax them.
It's a gentle challenge for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, we're switching it up on you. But Final Fantasy V does like to do that because they take – it's like – it's like, oh, well, you have four characters in your party. But sometimes they take those characters out of your party. Sometimes they make you fight a boss with one character. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, I hope you didn't neglect this character.
I think that was such
I hope he hasn't just been doing Geomancer the whole time.
It was such an aware moment on the part of the like the programmers to be able to sit there and go like, okay, we know you guys are going to like try to max this out. So let's give you challenges that force you to use all of these abilities in a unique way.
Yeah, right. And some RPGs do that. You know, they try to like say, oh, better make use of the characters that you didn't make use of.
Right.
Yeah.
And they fumble it. Like Breath of Fire 2 infamously has the part where you have to like fight through a really tough dungeon with I think the frog character that no one likes. So that's where a lot of people get stuck. But 5, you know, because you always have the four characters, almost always have the four characters in your party, and there's no reason not to swap jobs and, you know, kind of get the most out of your characters. I think it works unless you just play a really aggressively counterintuitive style. So that's good. But I would like to do this like this because I do think we should talk about the jobs, but we don't want to spend too long on it. So I'm going to name a job class and you're going to tell me why it's awesome or terrible. But Chris claims that there are no terrible job classes.
It's only terrible
only
people.
Terrible players.
Oh. Berserker.
Berserker is awesome in part because of Lena's outfit. Anyway.
Fair.
Or Reyna.
Well, do you want to just go?
Lena or Reyna? What's the official localization? Reyna? I can't remember. Is it Reyna or Lena?
No, it's Lena.
Okay, Reyna was like the that fan was the, translation.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, Reyna was the PS1 translation.
Oh,
but they've reverted back to Lena.
Okay.
Yeah. It's chunky salsa.
That's not nice. No fat shaming.
Hey, Ferris is my waifu out of all the characters possible.
She's pretty awesome. Okay, so freelancer. Why is it awesome?
Because when you play like I do, Freelancer is the best possible class of all classes. Mm. Being able to maximize all of the utility from every class and then being able to customize at will is basically – it makes it just by far and away the best.
Mm-hmm. Knight.
Oh,
come on.
I don't really like Knights.
Knights better in the early goings of the game to do physical damage and also to cover magic users.
Yeah.
So at that point are probably the lowest stats they're going to be. Yeah.
And then the passive that you get from the Knight is – dual like a two-handed sword attack?
Yes, two-handed. To hold one weapon in two hands.
Greatly increases your damage output.
Yeah, Knight's very good in the beginning
like
of the game.
Maybe 1.5x damage or something like that.
That can be great. Monk.
Oh, they hit super hard.
My favorite
times.
Class.
Big HP upgrades if you master them.
Yeah.
And everybody. It just looks hella cool when you're just punching people.
Yeah.
Doesn't,
I love the animation.
Doesn't Ferris wear like a gi when she's dressed as – or when she's a monk?
Hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
I looked down at my strategy guide.
Yeah, she's like Ryu. Thief.
They steal things?
See hidden passages. Also stealing. Yeah,
yes.
Stealing the Genji armor from Gilgamesh.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Genji stuff. This is like the first game that really had Genji stuff in it too, right? Or was it like – this was a game that
I never want to say first, but it was a big part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Fair. White Mage.
Healing. Yeah. You need someone to know white magic.
You're always going to have a white mage in your party.
True. Black mage.
Fire. Burn.
Blue mage.
Level 5 death. Also, Guardian or Mighty Guard, which is the spell that basically like gives you like protect and shell and not haste, but something else. It gives you a lot of good protections all in one.
I think it's like protect, shell, and regen at the same time.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yes. Something like that.
Is this the first game with that concept in it, learning enemy skills?
I think so.
I'm pretty sure it is. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and I love that. I really like that. This is my favorite class, actually. I try to make everyone a blue mage and learn as many special
Yeah, I love the blue magic stuff. And it also was a weird throwback to Final Fantasy VII because it felt like, oh, look, I can get Mighty Guard.
It's a throwback to a game that came several years later.
It's a throw forward.
Yeah, because this really does get to a point of Final Fantasy V in that, like, it's so geographically, like, in Japan, Final Fantasy V was a big breakout hit for the series. It sold almost double what Final Fantasy IV did.
That is incredible.
It is looked back on as being, like, this major, major game of the Super Famicom era. And I did play it in 95, but like so many Americans played it in after, and you
99.
Keep saying it's a throwback to tactics. It's
yeah,
a throwback
I'm sorry,
to Final Fantasy VII.
Like, I realize that it sounds so ridiculous when I say a throwback to like games that came decade after or whatever.
But it illustrates like how Americans experience it, and it's like that's why it's considered the weird black sheep in America, because people didn't experience it in its actual time period, its actual moment. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I found out about the game in real detail by reading Final Fantasy Tactics previews when it was releasing in Japan.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is just like FF5 they're saying. I want to play FF5. And then it came out in fan translation that October. So it was an interesting way to learn about the game.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I put in like thousands of hours into 7 in Tactics. And the fact that like when I finally got to 5 and you see, oh, this is where all that stuff you love came from, it really was just kind of eye-opening to me.
And, you know, a lot more things just than like battle modes. I mean, like right. Final Fantasy V wasn't the first game with Moogles, because they showed up for like a second in Final Fantasy III. But it was the first game where they were like all over the place. And like, you know, they had their own town and they became this really popular mascot. And there were a lot of things that Final Fantasy V did first. That,
yeah.
You know,
it just temporally out of space for us in America, like by so long.
And a lot of what we love about Final Fantasy V is down to the involvement of Hiroyuki Ito, who was the systems designer. He also, you know, did the job class in 3, but this was his shining moment. And he also worked on Final Fantasy Tactics, and he worked on Final Fantasy XII. And so, like, all these games that kind of build off of the job system and the super customization, that's him. And, like, a lot of what we think is, you know, iconic Final Fantasy was this one guy that you never really hear that much about. He just kind of keeps to himself. Mm-hmm. And he seemed, like I said, the time that I interviewed him, he seemed really amused, actually, that someone actually sought him out and was like, oh, this guy wants to talk to me? Let's talk about football. No, you made all these amazing systems. Let's talk about that instead. All right, so one of the interesting things about the job class is that you get the jobs in groups. That's kind of taken from Final Fantasy III also. But each job is associated with an elemental crystal, and there's one crystal that gets shattered, and so you don't actually get those jobs until later. Which, like, you're like, oh, I only get like 3 jobs this time. No, there's actually more, but you have to go find them.
I'm gonna push up my imaginary Coke bottle glasses, put the tape in the middle.
Oh
of them
my god!
To,
what have
to
I done?
Correct you again. No, each crystal shatters. The crystal shatters, and then you pick up the shards and get the jobs.
Yeah,
that's how you get the jobs.
Each shard is a job, or
but
something.
But there's the water crystal. When it shatters, one of the little shards ends up over a wall, and you can't reach it at the time, and you have to leave. And later, you go back to get that crystal,
okay, that's
the mimic class.
Anyway, so with the water crystal, you have the berserker.
It does sick physical damage at the cost of not being able to literally do anything else.
And it's really just handy when you're doing like the later level grinding, because it just auto attacks and you're like, okay, you know what?
Yeah.
Just go.
Yep.
As I said on the FF4 podcast, I just would cast that on Cecil and auto battle and it would just blow everything away.
Mm-hmm. Mystic Knight, which also is called Sorcerer and a few other things.
Just extraordinarily, if you have an enemy that is weak against an element, you want to use Mystic Knight and enchant your sword with that element, because it will do even more. Sometimes it doesn't even do 9999 damage. It's just an instant kill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No damage pops up and the thing just dies.
And if you combine that with the 2 swords ability, it's extra sweet.
Yes. And if you combine that with the Ranger's ability, as we all know.
Okay, we're back to square one.
Yeah, that's how you can cast Thunder on Omega, one of the super bosses.
And it was also a terrible Celtic-based Sentai show in America called Mystic Knight Aeternan.
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
It was like the Irish Power Rangers.
Exactly.
That was a good addition.
Oh, I remember, yeah. So actually, why don't we talk about Omega? Because that is like a little bit of a diversion here, but it's become such an iconic and important part of Final Fantasy now, the idea of a super boss that you have to really just crack open the systems and understand them on a, like, deep inside your soul, you know? You have to grok them.
Right. So let me start out with a history lesson. So this book that I wrote, it's not just me ruminating on Final Fantasy V. I actually conducted an extensive interview with Hironobu Sakaguchi, father of Final Fantasy, entirely about Final Fantasy V. And he was very nice. We went all the way back and we looked at everything. And one of the things that I brought up the super bosses, and he's like, ah, yeah. So there's a reason that these optional super bosses, which again started in Final Fantasy V and are now a mainstay of the series, he's like, we did this in Final Fantasy V because of this. Final Fantasy III, we really wanted people to experience that feeling of like making your characters really powerful and then overcoming seemingly impossible enemies with a clever combination of powers. In Final Fantasy III, we made that the final dungeon, and we really got a lot of criticism that the final dungeon was way, 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 way crazy too hard.
If they had added save points, it would have been fine.
It's pretty tough. So basically, with Final Fantasy V, they were like, okay, let's take those super hard encounters and make them purely optional. And so this is where we get Omega and Shinryu. And so Omega, the way to beat Omega is he's a machine, which means that he's weak against thunder because Final Fantasy. But if you just cast whatever thunder, it's like you're gonna die.
Like yeah, you're like scratching its surface.
He will basically, and it's not even
that
you're
like
scratching the surface.
A heat-based laser that he uses against all four characters. Right?
Yeah, he can pretty much. He might kill you in the first round, and he'll definitely kill you the second time he uses it. So you have to beat him quick. This is you can't just like grind him down. Like he does way too much damage to everybody too fast. So you get Ranger, you get Mystic Knight, and you get Ninja all on one person, and it essentially lets you cast the Thunder spell on Omega 8 times in one go. And basically I was able to beat Omega. It was just a matter of keeping Bartz, who had this ability, alive for a second round. If I could get him to round two so we could do it one more time, I beat Omega that way.
Omega is the one thing in this game that I have never been able to conquer.
Interesting. Interesting.
I cannot
spend
survive
more time in that basement.
No, I refuse. I will not.
There's your problem.
I will not.
So Shinryu, I don't think I've ever beaten Shinryu. And
oh, really?
I could go back because, I mean, really the way to do it is you have four dragoons and you give them all the dragon lances and you give them all jump and you give everybody coral rings so you can absorb his tidal wave. And then you jump with everybody and hopefully kill him in one round again.
Yeah, I did it without jumping.
Really?
I don't remember. I did use the coral rings because those absorb the water tsunami attack, which is the only way you can survive that.
But he has more attacks.
Right.
Right.
But I don't know. It's been a while since I've done it. I did it on the GBA version.
Oh, okay.
But whatever I did, I managed to beat Shinryu, and I was like, wow, I can't believe I did that.
Nice.
I can take on Omega now.
And
then I couldn't.
Then the great thing is you literally get, after you beat this, well, if you beat Omega, you get nothing except for
a ribbon,
key
right?
item.
Yeah.
No. You get a key item in your inventory that says this is a medal you got for beating.
Oh, that's what I meant. Like not ribbon, like Final Fantasy
ribbon.
I just meant like
a medal.
With a ribbon attached.
Right, exactly. And it's basically like
certificate of participation.
It's like an achievement. It's like it's like getting the achievement. That's all you get. Yeah.
But you know, if you have it, then you're awesome.
Yeah.
One thing I love about the GBA remake is that they were like, okay, Omega. Yeah, that's tough. But why do we make a dungeon?
Sure.
Full of Omegas.
Yep. Yep.
Because they're assholes.
Well, yeah. I mean, so you have a dungeon full of them. And by that point, I mean, the extra content in the Game Boy Advance version, they assume that you are – it's like now they know all your tricks and they assume you're using them. And what's interesting is I think if you look at all the – like the bosses in the extra Game Boy Advance content, they all have a powerful counter to if you use the scattershot ability. So they're looking for that and they will punish it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first time I tried that and you get against like Omega Mark II or something and it's just like, oh, we know what you're going to do and we just screwed you. And,
yep.
and that's when I kind of was just like, you know, I think I'm good. I think Final Fantasy V, we are good.
Yeah, but it's interesting how each game has its own take on the super boss. It started here, but, you know, Final Fantasy VI has a few different things. It has like Doomguys and Fumbaba, like these, not Fumbaba, but Doomguys and a few others, like these recurring enemies you have to fight multiple times. 7, of course, has the weapons. 8 just has Omega. There's Omega again hanging out in a castle, and by the way, he'll destroy you.
Did we mention 4 had one of those?
It had Ogopogo, but.
And
it wasn't,
like Neo Bahamut or whatever. In the final dungeon, you can get the crystal sword or something by fighting. When you open the treasure, you fight a huge, like crazy boss. In the moon?
Yeah.
There's one, at least one
but
of those.
Thing, well, the thing with Omega and Shinryu is that, I mean, with Shinryu, you can get Ragnarok if you beat him because it's in the treasure chest and that's the best sword. But at that point, you don't really need the best sword if you can beat Shinryu. And Omega is – there is no reward. It is purely – and it's also not a random encounter either. Like you choose to encounter him. Yeah. You get nothing. You get nothing but the pleasure of saying that you were able to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there we talked about that a little in the Final Fantasy IV episode about, you know, Ogopogo and like these extra elevated bosses in higher difficulty, but they're not on the same tier.
Oh, for sure,
Shinryu.
Yeah, they're not nearly
as difficult. Well, Shinryu and Omega are more difficult than beating X-Staff. Mm-hmm.
I think
and Ogopogo and whatever, like, yeah, they can be difficult, but like they're not harder than zero.
You can brute force them,
right?
In other
yes,
ways. Yeah.
That's the thing.
They're not puzzles.
You cannot grind your way through Omega and Shinryu. They are designed to test your knowledge of the intricate gaming system.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, is that Omega Shinryu were basically meant there to be like, you've spent 100 hours on this game. Mm-hmm. You've learned our system. Now can you put it into use? Do you know how to take this and work it properly to beat the hardest possible thing? And as like a gamer, if you're that specific type of spiky gamer who really wants to min-max and perfect it, it's just – that is the challenge you want. They're like, show me that you've mastered my system. And I think that's phenomenal. I think it was a fantastic idea and also super hard.
All right. We need to speed on through and get to the end of this because we're running low on time. So Time Mage, why is it awesome?
Haste.
Summoner. Yeah, kind of a –
Cool animations. How about that?
Right. Really cool animations.
Okay. Yeah. Red Mage.
Nice hat.
Red Mage gives you dual cast if you master it,
if
right?
You, yeah, but you have to like use –
It's like 999 AP.
But then you get dual cast. Okay, fine.
I don't know. Dual cast
useful
is pretty
useful in the beginning of the game.
I only mastered it just to have it mastered.
Yep.
Ninja.
Best
dual wield.
Yeah, dual wield for sure.
Dual wield. My favorite was going monk with dual wield for ninja just to go punch twice. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's again a legacy of my Final Fantasy Tactics is. But yeah, it's just – it's fun. Dual wielding is great. Mm-hmm. It always feels good.
Beastmaster.
You can control enemies and then force them to cast spells on you they otherwise wouldn't use.
Yep. So it's great for Blue Mage.
Yeah.
It's almost like a supplementary class.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good for completionist.
But I do like you know, capturing an animal and then unleashing it on the bad guys because you get sort of unpredictable effects and abilities that way. It's always kind of like a surprise. Like, all right, I'm unleashing my slave machine or my slave monster now. Let's see what it does.
How different is that from Gao? That sort of functionality, I never used the Beastmaster. I know Gao.
Gao is berserk. So once you use a rage, you can't control Gao.
But he like jumps on an enemy and the battle ends, and then he comes back. I think.
This is something totally different. Like you capture an enemy in combat, and then it like is kind of inside your party, like not usable, but you just have kind of it on retainer.
Okay.
And then you can unleash it for a one-time special attack.
Interesting. Okay. I never touched it.
Okay. Ranger.
Scattershot.
Well, I mean, the best ability in the game, right?
Just right.
Hands down.
Bard.
Bard is sick. Bard has Requiem, which does major damage to undead characters. So if you go into the Great Deep, the underwater dungeon in World 3, you just wreck everything with a Bard so hard.
If
you went and found Requiem.
But that's the one that has the minigame attached, right?
No. Oh, no, it's not the piano one.
Oh, what's the piano ability?
The piano one raises your levels.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's a good song to have.
Right, okay.
Yes, yeah.
Dragoon.
They look the coolest. That's why I play a Dragoon in FF14.
You can jump and then then all your other characters get attacked instead of Dragoon, which is sort of good and sort
Sorry,
of bad.
Guys.
And you can use the Dragonlance, which as a longtime Dragonlance fan, I was totally on board.
Of course. Samurai.
Coin toss.
Yeah. I mean, an element neutral – multi-target attack that only costs money. That's great.
Is that historically accurate? Did Samurai actually throw money at people?
They did. Okay. I don't know. Did they?
Well, it was weird for me because I come from the old school of, oh my god, you don't want to spend money in RPGs on anything. You might need it.
But again, then you get to X-Death and you're like,
and then you realize just how much damage it does, and it's like, okay, whatever, dude.
I know. And then you came out of the Balcastle basement, and because those things give you a lot of money too.
Right.
And you're rich.
Like, whatever, have it all.
This whole podcast is full of gamers telling you to stay in the basement. I just realized that.
Also, I'm curious if you're hitting them with the coins so hard that it hurts them or if you're just bribing them to go away.
Hmm.
Hey, X-Death, I'll give you some money if you'll not destroy the planet.
If you'll die, here's 1,000 gil.
Yeah. Go buy yourself a nice car.
I always thought of it like a nail gun of just going ding, 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 ding.
I think so. I think that's what
it's So here's a job that after playing Final Fantasy Tactics, you know, because I also did reverse chronology on this, I was really surprised that it's one of the most advanced and powerful classes, which is Chemist.
Hmm.
Chemist yes. is kind of amazing in this game, but it's really complicated. And I think the only game that has a similar approach to the Chemist class is Final Fantasy X.
Mm.
But you have the ability to like create your own potions and combine objects.
Right.
And some of the combinations, like you don't know what they are until you try them, but they're crazy.
Yeah. And you can
there's like the
things.
Hero drink, right? Where you like raise your levels or something.
Yeah, yeah. You can double everybody's level. You can double everybody's level, you can double everybody's HP, and you can spend time during the X-Death boss fight, you know, in the beginning, kind of just doing that. You can do things to enemies. I think you can berserk X-Death. If you want him to stop casting,
that's amazing.
Magic, you can only do it with Chemist. Like that, it lets you do things that enemies otherwise wouldn't let you do.
Yeah, I love the caption in the guide. Is like, when you run across an item that you have no idea what it's for, don't sell it. Just hang on to it because your chemist can do fun things.
Also, here's Chris's crappy translation corner. All those items were translated as cures alchemy. Cures. Alchemy.
Cures alchemy?
So it's basically, it's like, this is to be used in chemistry.
Oh.
But instead, they said, this item cures alchemy.
So if you have an alchemists.
Right.
If you can get rid of them.
If you catch the alchemy, you can drink this to get rid of it. That's literally what it says.
I keep turning lead into gold. Can someone help?
Yeah, please help cure me. Yes.
Cures alchemy. Wow.
Cures alchemy.
Finally, Mimic.
Very good if a character was a mage for most of the game and wants to like cast a bunch of spells, or even in fact wasn't, because it essentially just lets you mimic whatever the last action taken by a different character was. So like one person can cast flare, and then another person can go mimic and just cast flare too.
But does that carry over passive abilities? Like if you have scattershot and dual wield and stuff, you don't get 8 attacks by mimicking, right?
That's
I can't remember.
Excellent question.
I'm thinking no.
Actually,
I think I tried doing that,
yeah.
And I was like, oh, whatever.
Right. Maybe it's probably no. I think it's no. Yeah, they've got it.
I guess that'd be too good
or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be a bit much. Yeah.
All right. So anyway, that's I think we've kind
did
of
you forget
gone
the
through
Geomancer?
The systems. I
yes.
did forget the Geomancer, but doesn't everyone?
Yes.
Mm. Walk on lava, avoid traps. There's,
yeah, it's, there, it's
again,
good for
it's
passive
one of those
traits.
Things where there's a couple of, like, X-Death's castle at the end of World 2 is full of lava. It's full of holes. It's full of traps. It's full of spikes. Like,
I love the Geomancer in Final Fantasy Tactics. So
yeah.
I was looking forward to getting the Geomancer in this one, and I was like,
That's exactly what my reaction was as well. It's just like I love that guy almost for the entire game.
Right.
And
yeah, it's weird how some of the classes that are super useful in 5 become pretty much useless in Tactics.
Mog is a really
versa.
Fun character in Final Fantasy 6, of course, mm-hmm. because he's a dancer slash geomancer
slash berserker
slash berserker. Yeah, yeah.
There's
yeah.
a lot of berserking.
So basically,
in,
they took
Final
all
Fantasy
the
six.
Jank classes of 5 and made them amazing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
All right, so I think we've gone through most of this, but I do want to talk about Gilgamesh because mm-hmm. he is such an iconic part of this game and has become woven into the fabric of Final Fantasy, with Final Fantasy VIII.
Is Enkidu in this too, or does that
Yeah,
come
he
in
does
later?
Have his little buddy.
Is it a chicken? In 14, it's a green chicken.
No, he's like a demon or something.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
Like a little goblin or something.
I couldn't remember what Enkidu is in other games because he's in 14.
Flippy.
So Gilgamesh is, you know, based loosely on the hero of lore, like, the
literally one of the first stories.
Very loosely. But in this game, he's kind of this rogue element who sort of works for X-Death, but really he's just doing it because he's on a quest to discover the 8 legendary weapons and claim those for himself.
Yeah.
And he has eight arms, right? So, like, the idea is at the end, he's going to have the ability to wield all the legendary weapons at a time.
Yeah.
He's basically like the dude who wants to become super awesome. And, you know, so he sounds like really ruthless and menacing. And the first few times you encounter him, you're kind of like, whoa, he's really rough. But the further you get into the game, the goofier he becomes.
Yeah.
And in the end, he ends up sacrificing himself
to help
your party.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this I don't know. Like, it's the first sort of
And Amano's artwork makes him look like a weird, like, samurai clown.
Right.
Know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I love it.
I also just love
it's the first of the sort of, like, recurring goofy villain characters. Not like the four fiends in Final Fantasy IV, who you take seriously the whole time, but more like, you know, the Scorpion Army in Secret of Mana, or you know, the Turks in Final Fantasy VII, Cypher's Discipline Squad in VIII, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep. He's great. I mean, and then he shows up, I think, the second time, and he's just like, I found it. I have the Excalibur. And he uses it on you, and it does one damage.
Oh, no, it's Excalibur.
So in Japanese, Excalibur. If you know Japanese characters, ba and pa they look very, very, very much like
they're
each
identical,
other.
But for the diacritic mark.
Right. So basically,
which in pixel art is almost
the
identical.
Identical. So you could, if you look at the name of the item in your item list, you might mistake it for Excalibur, but it's actually Excalibur. If you look really close at, like, it's a difference of, like, it is literally a difference of two Super Nintendo pixels, right? And so that's the joke, and they translated it very well.
It's a very good translation.
Excalibur.
Yeah.
But it's – now the interesting – even – you know what? Even the humble Excalibur has a use, because the Excalibur always does one damage. But there are enemies that have one HP and an extremely high evade rate.
Oh.
But the Excalibur always does one damage.
Huh.
So the Skull Eater squirrels, which have one HP,
but they
run all the time, the Excalibur will kill them. And then they give you, I think, 5 ABP.
They're very valuable.
Yeah. So,
but they're also very dangerous.
They're
so
very dangerous unless you have the Excalibur.
Right.
And Final Fantasy Brave Exvius, again, had the battle on the bridge with Gilgamesh, and he gives you Excaliburs if you beat him. And if you beat him, like, all the way, you get the Excalibur. But it's just – I love that throwback to the fact that this weapon does nothing.
Well, Gilgamesh became this recurring character throughout the series, and it actually works within this game's story, because he sacrifices himself by basically falling into, you know, limbo, into a void. And so he starts popping up throughout the series.
Yeah.
Like, the first time he reoccurs is in Final Fantasy VIII when you're fighting, I believe, Odin. And I'm trying to remember exactly what happens, but basically what are you fighting? It's when you're fighting Cypher. And if you summon Odin or something like that.
I forget.
Anyway, Gilgamesh comes out. He's like, hey, what's up?
Yeah.
And he becomes like your summon. And then he shows up in Final Fantasy IX as just like a dude looking for lore in the library. He's an NPC that you don't fight. But, you know, Final Fantasy XII, he's there, et cetera, et cetera. He's just become
the new Cid.
Resurfaces through the series, and he's always on a quest for these legendary weapons.
Yeah, and when you fight him in 14, it literally plays the FF5 song, not rearranged, just the actual composition from that game.
Yeah, they did that in 12 also.
Oh,
Hitoshi Sakimoto arrangement of Battle on the Bridge. And that music right there, when you're – so that's actually a really interesting fight scene just within the context of the series, because it's like this ongoing, continuous fight. You're like being chased by Gilgamesh across a bridge trying to escape from a castle.
Right.
And so it's like as you run, you're constantly being harassed by enemies, and the music doesn't change. It's always like this – this very iconic sort of upbeat, almost like a – it's like kind of like a tango almost. It's very like –
yeah, I would call it rousing.
Yeah. Well, it's like a – it's kind of – it has sort of an ethnic feel to it. Like, yeah.
It does sound – tango-y.
Yeah.
And also because it just plays throughout the entire sequence instead of starting and stopping when the battles play. It just keeps playing.
That is like easily the most cinematic part of this whole game.
Yeah, it could be.
I'm dying here. I need to talk about the Final Fantasy V anime, people.
Okay, oh, go for it.
I'm losing my mind
okay,
here.
Okay, we'll
talk
about two more things.
Okay,
the anime and the fiesta.
Okay, sure. The anime is okay. I haven't watched it in maybe 15 years, but it was released in 1994. It was actually produced by the studio Madhouse, which is a pretty esteemed animation studio. They released four episodes.
That.
Yeah. And it's directed by a director named Rintaro, who has directed a lot of high-profile things, including the Osamu Tezuka version of Metropolis, which was an animated movie in 2001. The anime is weird, and it takes place 200 years after the events of Final Fantasy V. I don't remember a lot of it outside of the fact that the main villain is destroyed when the female character summons chocobos, and she just launches a ton of chocobos at the villain. And the chocobos in the anime are like plucked turkeys. They look nothing like like how they look in the game. And the other thing I remember is that because it's an anime from the 90s, whenever they find a crystal, the girl absorbs it into her body and then her butt lights up.
Yeah.
And that's really what I remember. But the animation is glorious and it looks really good. I don't think the story is great and they translate things in a strange way. But it was released on two VHS tapes in America in 1998, so a year before we got the official release.
So yeah, here's the thing about weird chronologies. When that thing came out, I remember because I was a diehard high school anime fan, and I was like, "There's a Final Fantasy anime?" And I saw it, and I was like, "What in the hell?"
It came here years before the game.
Yeah, and I had no idea that there was like – I thought it was like the Dragon Quest anime Dino Daibouken, which is just a random original story. I had no idea that it was related to Final Fantasy V until like 10 minutes ago, and
yeah,
it just blew
but also,
my mind.
But also like – I mean, God, That anime is bad. It's not good. It's
no.
not good. I mean,
the
animation is
really good, though.
Yeah, I can see liking the quality of the animation. It was an OVA, an original video animation, which is higher quality than TV. And it does have good people working on it, but God, the story was so dumb.
Yeah, I'm not going to bat for the story.
No, God. And you're right. I mean, basically, like, just like. It starts out with like as many panty shots as they can possibly
yes,
get of the
course.
And
yes,
then and then once you thought that like even that was not far enough, yes, the crystal, the wind crystal is like, oh, I'm going to take up residence in your butt.
I'm going in your butt.
And so whenever the wind crystal glows, everybody all gathers around and looks at her butt for like, you know, a good couple of minutes.
At least there's a narrative reason
about
for
the crystal.
It.
Yeah.
Yes,
be ashamed of your words and deeds, Chris.
Right. Yes, exactly. It's not great. And then of course chocobos look terrible. It's like they didn't get Final Fantasy.
Yeah, it's weird to make a version of it 200 years in the future, but with all different characters in a world that looks nothing like the original world that they're basing everything on. They just wanted to make their own thing, and they had licensing, I think, and that
Probably.
Was basically what they did.
I think so.
So there's a lot that I would really love to just keep talking about with this anime or this game, but we're totally out of time.
We're going
to
do an episode on the anime.
But yeah, I mean, I could just keep going. We got a ton of letters from people, and we're not going to have time to read any of those, and I apologize. Please look for them on the blog. I'm going to reprint them there because there were some really great comments, and we're literally out of time. The one last thing I do want to mention is that this game has become a force for good thanks to a guy named Eric Koziol, who I think I pronounced his name right.
Yes, I think so.
Who has created a thing starting on NeoGAF, and it's really expanded beyond that, called the Four Job Fiesta. And the idea is to basically play through Final Fantasy V as a group once a year or twice a year, and you sort of pledge, like, I will give this amount of money each time I get a crystal or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it
and then beat the game.
Ways.
Yeah,
you give money to charity,
but basically, yeah, the idea
is
that you play through the game and you don't get to control which of the four classes you play as. But with each crystal, you are basically given like a bot on Twitter gives you an assignment. Like, you can only use this job. You can only be white mage. You can only be bard. Mm-hmm. And
you get one job per crystal.
One job per crystal.
And then
you have to beat
after the
game.
First crystal, you have a party of four whatevers, like mm-hmm. that happens to be. Maybe it's four white mages. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's become this thing that has been going for years. And people jump in every year and contribute money. And mm-hmm. each year it brings in a little more money. It's a really great thing.
And not only is it a cool thing for charity, I think it has done wonders for the image of Final Fantasy V, absolutely. Especially here in America. Because now that people are playing it and like being forced to use job classes outside of their comfort zone, it's really shown that like you know, Final Fantasy V is this amazing, amazing system.
There are very few games that could have supported a concept like that.
Right.
Like, that but, have the strength of design and the diversity of design to make
and
that
it,
possible.
And it forces you to learn about all the ways you can use the different classes and really plumb the depths of everything. And people have found out you can beat the game with any arbitrary group of four jobs that you just stick with. Like, it is totally possible. Somebody only just recently, this happened a couple of years ago, but somebody beat the game with four berserkers.
Wow.
Which was just – it was
God,
not
– that must
was,
have been brutal.
It was not thought to be possible, but he figured out a way to do it.
Damn.
Yeah.
God, can you imagine Fork Tower with berserkers? Oh, God.
Yeah.
The thing is, the class challenge for the Fiesta is such a wonderful way to force you into, like, restricting your ability in – such a deep – it shows the real depth of the system of Final Fantasy. And this game just is – I think maybe the only game that you could do it with except for Tactics. And even in Tactics, it's easier.
It's an example of restraint, like creativity emerging from restraints. You would never think to like, okay, well, what can I do with a white mage and a blue mage? But then you'll figure that out.
In Magic the Gathering, the lead designer's favorite phrase is restrictions breed creativity.
Yeah.
Which is literally this game. It's like, okay, you've got a berserker, you've got a bard, and you've got like a chemist. Go to town.
Right. So finally, to wrap up, this game did see a few remakes after the initial American PlayStation release, which was bad. The first was on Game Boy Advance, which got a new localization, a
fantastic.
Good localization.
Yeah.
And also got the bonus dungeons at the end, plus two new classes, which are weird, and I don't really know what to do with them. But one of
four
them
new
is
classes.
Oh, four?
Yep.
Yeah.
There's Cannoneer. There's
Necromancer,
and what are the other two?
Gladiator and Oracle.
Oh, I forgot about those. Yeah, like you really have. I don't know. I didn't really get a feel for those because you use them sort of in the post game.
Yeah. Well, it's taking something that's perfect and then throwing four more things in
Gilded
there. And
the
it's
Lily.
Like, yeah.
Which is it's kind of what Tosei did with all of those Final Fantasy remakes.
Sure.
They're just like, let's just throw in some extra crap.
At least
I like the stuff they added to four, but all the other games it's kind of like. Meh.
At least they cared enough to do that, which is not the case
that's
for the
true.
Other remake.
Tell us about it, Bob.
It's utter trash, probably made by children in slave labor. I've seen RPG Maker projects literally made by high schoolers that have a higher level of quality than these Final Fantasy V and VI remakes.
You're talking about iOS?
iOS,
and Steam?
Yes. It was an iOS remake, and then it was a they put it on Steam. And as with all those iOS remakes for PC, they look even worse, obviously, on a TV. And the only saving
like
grace –
literally, it's still designed for touch controls.
Yes, yes.
But it's on your PC screen.
That is awful.
They just graft an awful UI to it, like with the most cheap generic font. It looks bad. To their credit, they at least try to follow the Amano designs, but that just means, oh, all my characters have white hair and they still look bad. But the only saving grace was I got this on Steam. I was like, I'll give it a chance. I know it's going to be bad. This is the most convenient way for me to play this game. I started. I was like, oh, this looks bad. I can't even look at it. The menus are terrible. And then 8 minutes in, it crashes. I'm like, oh. Then I try playing it again. 8 minutes in, it crashes. I'm like, okay, I just saved myself. I dodged this bullet. Then I downloaded the ROM for the GBA version. And I played it that way. And I'm like, this is fine. So once again, stealing was the correct answer for retro games.
Speaking of white hair, one of the weirdest little quirky things about this game was the old status.
Old, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
We forgot to mention that, but your characters can turn old, and that makes them, like, weaker, right?
Thank you for asking, Jeremy. Old reduces an enemy's level over time, and there's level 5 death and there's level 2 old. So if you cast level 2 old on somebody, their level starts to go down.
That's so weird.
And if they had then you can wait until their level is a multiple of 5 and cast level 5 death on them.
Nice.
That is some combo right there.
Yeah.
Man.
That's the
like crazy Japanese speedrunner kind of thing.
That reminds me of how FF7 has like sad and hyper.
Oh, yeah.
I still don't know what those are.
So anyway, we'll talk about that in the Final Fantasy VII episode. Unfortunately, speaking of time, we're out of it now. So we need to wrap up. Hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish. This has been my hosting on this episode. You can find me at retronauts.com because that's what I do. I'm on Twitter as GameSpite. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Chris Kohler. I'm the author of a forthcoming book called Final Fantasy V, all about Final Fantasy V for Boss Fight Books. If we timed this correctly, the Kickstarter for Boss Fight Books Season 4, which includes my book, is online right now, probably bossfightbooks.com. And so you can, if you want to spend the money before you've seen the goods, you can pre-order the book essentially through Kickstarter. So if you're listening to this episode, you probably want to read this because there's some good stuff in there for you.
Hi, I'm Shivam Bhatt, and these days I'm kind of a cultural commentator. And you can find me on Twitter at Electrotel, and if you want to listen to me talk about magic and or politics.
Oh, and I'm Bob, of course. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I do a comedy article for SomethingAwful.com every Thursday at SomethingAwful.com. And my other podcast is Talking Simpsons. It's a chronological exploration of The Simpsons. Every Wednesday, it's a new episode in order. And we recently had the great Bill Oakley on our show as a guest. He was the co-showrunner of season 6 and 7 and wrote for the show for 5 years. So he approves of us, and so should you. So every Wednesday at LasertimePodcast.com or TalkingSimpsons.com. Thank you.
And of course, Retronauts, you can find us on iTunes or on Podcast One. We are supported through your love via Patreon.com, Patreon.com/Retronauts. Also by ads. If you subscribe on Patreon, then you get the episodes a week early and also without ads. So how's that for a prospect? Anyway, your support keeps us alive. Your listening keeps us alive. It's awesome. We love you. We love Final Fantasy V. You should play Final Fantasy V because we love you both. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again in a week with another episode and stuff.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.